Welcome back to Learning to Lead. This week I'm going to do something that wasn't really in the plan originally, but as we've been talking about the leader over these last 10 weeks or 10 sessions, it's been a growing list in my mind and heart about things that I wanted to share but didn't quite fit into the topic. And so you'll notice that the title of this session is simply Final Reflections on the Leader. What does it mean for you to be a leader? We've looked at a lot of different things about who you are as a leader and what you are as a leader and the tasks of a leader and those sorts of things. But today we're just some random thoughts, and so nothing really all that organized, but things that are true to me and are on my heart as a leader. So just a reminder, leaders engage culture, and they do that to engage a vision for the future, a preferred future, and then they give the impetus to the planning and the prayer that will lead the organization forward. Now, first thing I want to talk about is maybe best illustrated in the Johari window. Johari window was developed back in 1955 by two researchers, sociologists, psychologists, a man named Joe and a man named Harrington, and so they named it after their first two names, Johari. And it's a process by which you understand a little bit about who you are and how you present yourself. And so what happens when you fill out the survey for the Johari window is that there's a whole bunch of adjectives that describe who you are, and you check the ones that you think describe who you are. And then your friends or peers or coworkers are given that same list, and they say, which adjectives describe this person? And so they check those. And then they put all that together in a creative way, and they come out with Johari window, and you'll notice there's four segments. On the top is the self, and what you are, what you know. These are things you put down, and you know them about yourself, so you've identified them as yourself. But then on the right-hand side, you say there's parts of you that are blind. In other words, you don't see some parts of yourself, and those come out in some cases in what the other people indicate as true of you. For instance, you may not see a shyness in you, and yet your coworkers, your peers, they see that, and so they indicate that on their questionnaire. Or you may present some arrogance, and you don't see that. Your mind is blind to it, your self-denial, whatever. They identify it, or you don't see yourselves as really presenting yourself forcefully to people, and yet they do. And so that top part is, what do you know about yourself? There's the known and the open part on the left-hand side on the top, and that's what they know and you know about yourself. And then there's those parts that you don't know on the right-hand side. Now, you look on the other side, there are some things you don't let other people know, and that's what's called secret. And in order to take those secrets away, there has to be disclosure. But there are certain things that you know about yourself, but you don't let other people know. And then on the right-hand side is unknown. There are things that you don't know about yourself, and they don't know because you don't let them know. And those are the hidden parts of yourself. Now, the whole theory behind this is, the reason I bring it up is simply this. These two things, what you know about yourself and what you present to others, can get out of balance. And as a leader, that can be a tremendously draining time for you and can be a disastrous time for you. Years ago, I went to a counselor, and I was there for some depression. I'd been working way too hard, and there were a variety of things in my life that were just not integrated. And so I went to try to get some clarity on all of that. And I remember at one point he had this big pad of paper in his office, and he drew a kind of a stick man, much like the large one there. And he said, you know what, this is what you present to people. And then he drew a littler one inside, and he said, and this is who you really are. And he said, one of your problems is that the outside, what you're presenting to people, is getting too big for the little one to hold up. Now, this can happen to you. Because you are a leader, people are going to accord to you or project on you knowledge that you don't really possess. They're going to believe that you're wiser than you really are. They're going to believe that you've got skill that you don't really have. They're going to picture you as far more spiritual than you really are. They're going to picture you as a person of great character when you know down deep you've got character flaws and you've been keeping those in the hidden part of the Johari window. And the bigger you get out of proportion to what people see and present compared to the person you really are, the more likely there's going to be a disaster coming down the road. Now, what does that look like? Well, it looks like a failure in one way, shape, or form is what it looks like. But it happens. And it happens because we let it happen. Now, people naturally are looking for heroes in our world today. And we do this with heroes in a variety of kinds. You know, movie stars are always thought to be smarter and wiser and more knowledgeable than what they really are. In fact, several years ago, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill in the House of Representatives because our government here in the States was concerned about the fact that family farms were disappearing. Big corporations were taking over farms and melding them in, and the family farm is dying out. And so should they create some laws about that? Should they protect the family farm in some way, shape, or form? Well, two of the people they asked to testify were Jane Fonda and Jodie Foster, two well-known actresses here in the United States. Now, what possible contribution could they make to a discussion about the family farm? Well, they were asked to testify because they had played the wives of farmers in movies. Our culture creates heroes, and we believe those heroes are bigger than they really are, wiser than they really are, and people are going to do that to you if you're a leader. And the only way you can fight that is to be revealing of yourself. Transparency to a degree. Now, I don't mean that this means you should, every ache and pain you've got, you should share with people and come on Sunday morning at a worship service and say, I got such a headache this morning, I don't think. And that's not what I'm talking about. But that you don't allow people to put you up on that pedestal and you identify more with the broken people, the broken person that you really are. And so you can be honest about the fact that times may be difficult for some people because they want you to be a hero. But to be honest and be able to say that sometimes, you know, you pray and you're just not sure how God is answering. That sometimes you really don't understand this part of Scripture as you read it. And parts of Scripture that come to mind. To be transparent is going to be very important in your world as a leader. And so just want to encourage you. That's just one thought that came to me as I was thinking about things I hadn't yet covered. So take that for what it means for you. Second little lesson is to focus on your strengths, not your weaknesses. I put up a quote there by Peter Drucker, who is a management expert here in the United States. When you focus on your strengths, you make your weaknesses irrelevant. Now, not too long ago, when I started studying leadership, they talked about the fact that if there are staff within your company or your business or your church, you should do an evaluation with them that will help them perform more effectively. And usually part of that evaluation had two questions. What are your strengths and what are you doing to live out those strengths? And number two, what are your weaknesses and what are you doing to grow out of your weaknesses? And so you would identify things there like, you know, I'm not very organized. So, you know, this year I'm going to take a class on organization and management and hopefully that will help me do that better. Or I'm not a very good communicator. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to just spend a whole lot more time this year practicing my communication. I'm going to take a class at the local community college or the local whatever it is. And I hope that's going to improve my ability to communicate, etc. So you try to grow your weaknesses. Now, studies have been done over and over again. Drucker is referring to one of those as he puts this on his list. And he says, you should focus on your strengths. Marcus Buckingham is another another researcher from England who beats this drum over and over again, is to focus on your strengths. Now, what is a strength? Four signs of a strength. Success. When you do it, you feel effective. People tell you that you have a gift for this activity. You've earned prizes or recognition for the activity. Instinct. Before you do it, you actively look forward to it. You find yourself volunteering for this activity. This activity is a positive gut reaction for you. Or growth. While you're doing it, you feel inquisitive and focused. You find yourself thinking about this activity and you can't wait to learn more. Or needs. After you've done it, you feel fulfilled and authentic. It's fun to think back about doing this activity, and doing this activity is one of your greatest satisfactions. You notice the source is Marcus Buckingham in a book, Go Put Your Strengths to Work. This isn't to say you ignore your weaknesses. What it means is that you find people to compensate for your weaknesses, people who are strong where you are weak. You cannot do it all, and so you're going to need other people in your life. I just share two fundraisers. Early in ministry, I was asked to do a fundraiser for a hospital here in the States that they're a wonderful thing. They would take children without any proven ability of the parents to pay for their treatment. And especially children with developmental disabilities or recovering from accidents, they would take them. They would treat them. If the child had cancer, it didn't matter how much it cost, they wouldn't charge beyond what insurance would pay if they had insurance, but the hospital would cover the cost. Good cause. And I agreed to do this fundraiser. And I found myself miserable for the 3 months that were ramping up to this great day when we're going to have this bike festival in a local high school. And I found I was just overwhelmed. I was busy in ministry, but now I was trying to, one, make sure I rented the school for this. One, I got to get communication out to the local radio station, the newspaper. I've got to, try to find communication to this area. I had to go to stores, and I solicit gifts from them. I had to create entry forms and keep an idea of who was entered into this and who was not. The day came, and I was miserable. And in fact, the only thing that redeemed that day for me is that nobody showed up. And I realized I failed. But I failed because I was trying to do something outside of my strengths. I was trying to do something in management and details and administration. And so after that, I began to find people whenever I agreed to do something or saw that as part of the vision. And so fundraiser number two happened many years later, and we had a desire to increase our missions giving. Now, we had had a very generous person who gave a significant amount of money to our church, and we were to distribute that over 10 years in supporting these kinds of missionaries so that there was a mission emphasis of some sort to the church, even though the church didn't cost them a dime. Well, that gift was coming to its end. And so we set out a goal, a vision of let's double the amount that we pay over this next year out to various missions and missionary agencies. And so we created a process, a service, and we did all of this wonderful stuff in planning to double the amount that we were giving, which was already significant, though it wasn't a church thing. Well, I remember the day when we were setting this whole thing up, and the woman that I chose as the key administrator looked at me and said, "Oh, don't you just love it when things come together like this?" I had to laugh because I said, "No, I don't. That's not where jazzes me. What jazzes me is getting the idea and laying out the vision and communicating the vision. See, we're not meant to be on our own. We need other people around us. And so the more you can, focus on your strengths, and you will be better for it as a leader. Check your motives. Why do you do what you do? Now, nobody is perfect in their motives. Nobody is perfectly clean and saying, "I'm doing this all for the glory of Jesus." That you may want to say that, but down deep you know that some of it's for you. But sometimes there's a question. I was speaking with a seasoned leader last week, and this person has been a leader for generations. He's now in his 70s, and he's just taken on leadership of a new task. And he was just reflecting. He says, "I wonder sometimes if I'm doing this just so that I can feel good as a leader." Because he had retired from the position he had that caused him to be a leader in a variety of ways, raising funds, giving vision, and now he's retired. And he says, I wonder if I'm doing this because I love Jesus. It's a great, great opportunity. He's working with a homeless situation, homeless people, and getting them into housing and getting them educated and getting them launched into new jobs and professions and training that comes with that. He's doing wonderful work. He says, "I wonder if am I really doing this for God? Am I doing this because I need this?" Every once in a while, it's a good thing to check your motives. Say, what is the driving force here? Am I doing this because I get to be in front? I get to be on stage. I get to have people clap when they see me, be happy when they see me? Or am I doing this because I want to serve Jesus? Talked about that a little bit, but that's one that I want to just reflect on. Is it about you? Is it about you or is it about Jesus? That was what my friend was wondering. just another reflection is to allow for margin in your life. Richard Swenson is a medical doctor and wrote a book several years ago now called Margin, which he defines this way: restoring emotional, physical, financial, and time reserves to overloaded lives. That's the subtitle to the book. He defines margin as having breath left at the top of the staircase, money left at the end of the month, and sanity left at the end of adolescence. Now, what he means by this is the fact that if you take a page and you start writing on the page, you always leave margins, right? In other words, if you've got to come back and you're going to use this speech, you can write something in the margin and add that into the speech. And if you use a computer, you've automatically got a margin set at 1 inch. And so that 1 inch is reserved, a little more at the top or the bottom than the sides, but you've got margin there. Well, one of the things he noted as he looks at life now in this 21st century is that we tend to fill in the margins until there is no margin left. And as a result, we're exhausted. We are always working behind the eight ball as far as being people who are energetic and moving forward. And so he says margin is making room for what really matters. Now, we've all done this. There are times of crisis in life and in your leadership when you're just going to have to buckle down and you've got to do some things. One of the leaders I speak with regularly is a young man who has had 22 funerals in his church in the last 6 months. Now imagine, that's two a week. And funerals take so much extra energy. There's meeting with the family, there's planning the funeral, there's gathering the instrumentalists or the musicians that are needed, there's putting together whatever you can to help the family get through that situation. And then there's the emotional baggage when somebody, you've got to walk with people through that death when somebody has died. You've got to walk through that loss with them. And he's done that 22 times. And as a result, his margin started to get fuller and fuller and fuller and fuller. He didn't have time to enjoy his family and kids. And yet when we were talking, we said, well, okay, what can you give up during this time to create more margin in your life? He couldn't think of a thing. He could have given up preaching as pastor in a church, but didn't want to do that. Or you could give up leading this group. Oh, no, I can't do that. That needs direction right now. Now, the point is that if you're going to remain healthy, you've got to find ways to have margin in your life so that when the crises come, they don't just overwhelm you and put you in a depression. The young man I'm talking about said, I'm ready to quit at the end of that 6 months. Now, it didn't have to be that way. Create margin in your life. Prayer is essential. Now, I've mentioned prayer before, but now I want to talk about your own personal prayer life as a leader. I led into this when I was working on a doctoral program at Fuller Theological Seminary in California, Pasadena. And at that time, the Korean churches in Southern California were growing by leaps and bounds. In fact, it seemed like you could put 10 Koreans down on a corner and you'd have a thriving church in a matter of days or weeks. And in the class I was taking at that particular time, there was about four or five of these young Korean men who were in that class. And so during one of the breaks, I went up to them and I said, tell me the secret. Would you tell me the secret about, you know, how do you grow the church? How is it thriving the way we all see these Korean churches thriving? And the man looked at me instead of answering, because I'd hoped he was going to give me a program or a process to follow. And instead he said, what's your prayer life like? Well, my prayer life was pretty typical for an American pastor, which is about 7 minutes a day at that time. And I prayed in the morning. I prayed over meals. I prayed with my wife quite regularly. But I didn't have any sustained time of prayer. That was just me communicating with my father. And then he said, well, let me tell you what my prayer life is like. And he described getting up, being in his prayer closet in his office at 5 a.m. And then at 6 a.m. he met with other people of the church, leaders in the church, to be praying. On Friday night they would have a prayer vigil that would go all night from 9 p.m. to 9 a.m. And they would pray all night. And then at least one time during the year, it was a requirement on his part, it was an expectation within that culture, that he would go away and spend time on Prayer Mountain. Now, in Korea, there is such a place that is called Prayer Mountain. And it's a place with all booths where you can spend time in concentrated prayer. And that's his prayer life. He said, that's why we're growing. He said, go home and read the book of Acts. So I did. that ended up being part of my doctoral dissertation was a study of the book of Acts and the fingerprints of God, where we see God at work in the book of Acts. But since then, I've come to realize how important prayer is. Now, I put down there Acts 17. That's the story of Moses up on the mountain. You remember, they're going through the wilderness, and the Amalekites attack the Israelites. In fact, they're attacking the stragglers at the back of this train of people. That's a couple of million people along. Instead of God just taking care of the problem, as he has before this, God has fought for them before this all the time, right? The plagues in Egypt, the Red Sea being parted, the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire. God has always fought for them. But now God takes a different tact and he says, tell Joshua to get some men and go out and fight them. So Moses tells Joshua to do that. And Moses goes up on the hill to pray. Joshua picks probably the best fighters he knew, even though they had no fighting experience up until this point. And they go out to battle the Amalekites. Moses is up on the hill. We don't know why he's up there, whether he's there so that the people of Israel can see him and be encouraged, or so that he can direct his prayers, you know, like saying, oh God, they're about to break through over on the right side. Please protect them. Make Joshua brave. Make those men down there brave. We don't know why he was on the hill, but he was on the hill. And he was praying. He was lifting up the rod of God. Now, this was the rod he had as a shepherd when he was in Midian. And it's a rod that when he threw it down as a sign of God's power and presence, it turned into a snake. It's a rod that he held out to invite many of the plagues that demonstrated the power of God over all of Egypt. It's the rod that he used to stretch out over the Red Sea, and the power of God came down and parted the Red Sea. It's that rod, the symbol of the presence of God. And so he's holding it up and praying. But he gets tired and his arms start coming down. And so Aaron and Hur come and they hold up his arms. And of course the Israelites are victorious. And then God speaks to Moses, and he says, now this is a good lesson time. He says, write this down, what happened here. And make sure Joshua knows. Make sure Joshua knows. Because he might think it was him. He might think he had such a great battle plan, what an amazing thing happened that he won. Now that's been instructive to me because I had to realize that I've got to be active in prayer. But not only just myself, I've got to have others active in prayer. Peter Wagner, who was a church growth expert from years past, used to talk about having three levels of intercessors that we recruit for ourselves as leaders. First level is somebody that is intimate, one or two people that you can share almost everything with, and they pray for you personally and present. And then I, too, are intercessors. The second level of intercessors are those that are close to you and willing to pray for you on a regular basis. I sent out an email every single week which listed my prayer concerns, my thanksgivings, things that they could praise God for, where we'd seen answers to prayer, but then requests for this coming week, and then listing my schedule for the coming week so that they would know when I was meeting and what I was doing, when I was leading a service somewhere. And these people committed to pray for me every day. There were like 30-some of them. Those were my I-2. And then the I-3 intercessors are just the people who say, would you pray for me? And they agree to do that, and they put you on their prayer list. Prayer is essential. And the more you can recruit people praying for you, even the Apostle Paul says that often, you know, pray for me, pray for me. It's your prayers. I'm going to be delivered because of your prayers. What a thing for him to say that. So prayer is essential. And I could have made that a whole lesson on its own, but I tack it in here. But anyway, so today, the lessons are, to be as transparent as you can with your people and not let them put you on a pedestal. Focus on your strengths and not your weaknesses. Don't try to improve your weaknesses as much as focus on your strengths to become stronger. Check your motives. Allow for margin in your life. And pray. And have other people praying for you. And you'll be a more effective leader.